Thank you, Anna, for joining us today. Now, before we get started, how would you define exhaustion? Like, what are the signs a person should be looking for?
Yeah, that's a great question. And thank you for having me on your show, Carl. Exhaustion. So the kind of exhaustion I'm interested in is exhaustion that is sort of in between the mental and the physical. So it's not just a kind of tiredness that we can get from, you know, effort, from having overexerted ourselves. But the kind of exhaustion I'm looking at and that I tend to work with my clients in overcoming that kind of exhaustion is somewhere between the mind and the body. It doesn't have very clear causes and it's chronic. So I think exhaustion tends to be, you know, tends to manifest in a feeling of weariness, of heaviness, of depletedness, hopelessness. So there's a mental dimension to exhaustion. So we can feel hopeless and, you know, very despondent and very worn out and, you know, without kind of optimism for the future. And in our bodies, exhaustion can feel heavy. It can feel like, you know, gravity is pulling us down and we have very little energy to hold ourselves upright. And I think exhaustion also manifests in kind of a strange, in being trapped in a strange no man's land between rest and work. You know, like really seriously exhausted clients can neither work nor do they allow themselves to rest. And that's the dangerous state. You know, that's the kind of state where we burn out, when we languish and we can neither actually recover our energy nor can we be productive in any way.
So that's kind of the interesting thing for me. So there's like a difference between, like, exhaustion is maybe the first step and then burnout is the end game, so to speak.
Burnout often follows on from, you know, from chronic exhaustion, and burnout is one more extreme version in the sense that the clients with whom I work who are seriously burnout, many just can't function anymore. They can't work anymore. And they also don't allow themselves to recuperate, or they don't know how to do that anymore. Right, you know, they've lost all connection with what gives them joy and what replenishes them. So it's, I mean, burnout is a really, really serious state, and severely burned out people often have to change profession. You know, they just cannot go back into their old jobs because it's an area invested with a lot of trauma, and their bodies just say no at some point. They say like, I can't go on like this.
So is there like anything like an early warning sign that somebody should be aware of? Because we do hear a lot about, you know, exhaustion, burnout, breakdown. I mean, all these words are bandied about in the media. But what I'm always curious about is, well, there's obviously got to be a first sign that this is happening or potentially going to happen. Is there any signs that people should be looking out for?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think joylessness, you know, when we lose our capacity to experience joy, when nothing really, we don't allow ourselves anymore to engage in activities that make us happy because we feel like we should be working all the time. So we spend almost our entire lives working, and we can't really be very productive at work anymore either. And I think cynicism, you know, depersonalization is one of the core symptoms of burnout. So we become very cynical about our work, about our colleagues, sometimes the people for work with whom we work. And I think a sense of tiredness, a lack of energy, you know, everything is work, you know, even moving ourselves around, even getting up, brushing our teeth. I think these are definitely warning signs. And I would also add to that a kind of sense of hopelessness. So, like, life turns gray. It's like someone switched on a cosmic gray filter. And I think that's when we are in a state of extremely serious exhaustion where we often need outside help.
Right. So of course it's perfectly normal, would you say, to have the occasional bad day. What you're talking about is this is just something that just perpetually just seems to stay with you for days, weeks, months, however long. Because I know I have bad days, but they are very, very rare, fortunately. And it's probably because I've probably been pushing myself a little bit too hard. It's just thinking, oh, okay, I need to back off a bit here. I get that. I was just thinking, because I think most people at some point are going to have bad days. They're just going to feel tired and down and a bit gloomy. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
I was going to say, in your opinion, though, would you say that this has become a bigger problem in, say, the last 10, 20 years? Or is it just the media that's maybe talking about it more than they used to do 20 years? I mean, is it getting worse or has it always been around?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So I have written a book on the long history of exhaustion. And I argue in that book that people have always feared exhaustion, always battled with exhaustion, always been anxious about exhaustion's effects, you know, both on the individual and also on society as a whole. So I think exhaustion is not a new experience. It's partly what makes us human, you know, the mm-hmm. understanding that our energies are limited, that we worry about wasting them, losing them for good, squandering them, and not being able to replenish ourselves. So I think that fear has been with us since, you know, time memorial. But I do think that in our age, we obviously have new exhaustion generators, like new technologies, communication technologies, social media, permanent connectivity, and also, you know, working from home scenarios, which some people love, other people detest. And we also have a lot of, I think, new psychosocial pressures, you know, with having internalized a very damaging attitude to time and productivity and to always having to be hyper efficient and effective. There's a faster pace of life now that I think can get to a lot of people. And I do also think that, you know, competitive capitalism adds new stressors in the sense that we become, you know, much more worried about, you know, winning and losing and staying on top of the game. And these kind of scenarios, I think they have added to making exhaustion a more prevalent and acutely felt phenomenon.
Well, you mentioned there about the, like, that kind of push towards increasing our productivity and efficiency and all that combines with that. And now, would you say that the mental state of that push towards productivity is a contributor towards us feeling more exhausted and more burnt out?
I think so. I don't want to step on your toes, Carl.
No, because I am completely with you on this, because okay, I think one of the things that I have to do in my line of work is to slow people down and make them realize that they don't have to do everything in one day. So don't worry, you're not treading on my toes. I think we probably are singing from the same hymn sheet, as they say.
I think this, you know, this idea that we have to enhance our productivity and be hyper productive at all times is a huge stressor, and a lot of us have internalized that, you know, this desire to maximize our time, to maximize our capacity to work, the speed at which we work. I think that can be hugely damaging, you know, because we cannot function at a super high level at work all the time. I think we need rest, we need joy, we need recuperation time, we need time with other people. And a lot of research, I'm sure you know, that has shown that it's not actually the quantity of time that we put into work, but quality of time. So, you know, sometimes it can be much more beneficial for us to work a couple of hours with a high level of concentration a day and then do stuff that is good for the soul, you know, that makes us feel happy to be alive. But I think a lot of us feel like we have to work all the time, and I include myself here, you know, I'm not very good at taking breaks, and I often feel like I need to work and use every single minute of my life to work. And that is exhausting. And it's also ironically not very effective, you know, because we can't work at that kind of level of concentration for many, many hours in a row. So I think we really do need to relearn the art of, you know, bringing a better balance into our lives, and also not fetishizing productivity so much, you know. I mean, productivity is a good thing, but I mean, also, do we need to be hyper productive at all times, you know?
Correct.
What for?
I mean, it's one of the things that what always struck me was, if we look at our ancestors, they really only had one objective in the morning, which was, whenever they woke up, was find food. One objective. If they were lucky and they found food early in the day, the rest of the day was sitting around talking, chatting in their tribe. And if they were unlucky, they came back exhausted. But it was one day they were exhausted. You know, they'd spent all day running around chasing an animal or foraging or whatever. But that was it, one objective a day. And the way I see the problem with productivity today is we don't just have one objective. We have 100 objectives and we don't know which one to do. And then our brains just start panicking and, it becomes a real mess. So, yeah, a lot of it is, that's why I say, is slow down. You don't have to do everything in one day. Be aware of what's important and what's not important. So, it's true. Yeah. I think I've forgotten that there was a wonderful phrase. It's about productivity that is, I think the negative side is that push, when really it's not so much about that. It's more about identifying what's important to you and to your work and making sure that gets done. And then the rest of the time, being aware of your feeling, how you're feeling, which actually, you actually say on your website that you help people to transition from a state of exhaustion to a state of vitality. Now, one of the things that I picked up, I think this is a quote from Tony Robbins, which is, where your focus goes, your energy flows. And it is really true. I've noticed the same thing. If I get really excited about something because I'm really focused on it, my energy is like very high. But if somebody is feeling exhausted, and to move them to that state of vitality, are there three simple things that somebody could do who's listening to this interview that could try out and, move closer to the vitality side than the exhaustion side?
There are a couple of things. And I think the very first and most important one is self-knowledge. We need to understand what exhausts us and what gives us energy. And often, even that isn't quite clear. Sometimes exhaustion drags us into a really murky zone where we lose all contact with our feelings and our values and our deeper aims and purpose in life. And I think the first step is always self-knowledge. What motivates us? Why do we want to achieve a certain goal? And what energizes us and what drains us of energy? So that is a really important first step to understand, which factors. And then the second step is very much what is under your control and what isn't under your control. Which of the exhaustion generators in your lives can you control and which ones can't you control? And of course, that's an old Stoic principle, the idea of the circle of control. And the ancient Stoics believed that we can only really control our inner life, our thoughts, our feelings, our responses to external events. And that's always a very, very good starting point. And, sometimes it can be a great relief when we let go of our attempts to try and control external circumstances that we can't control. And instead we focus on, how we feel, how we react to external circumstances. So I would say the circle of control is the second important technique that we can use when we're extremely exhausted. And the third one is to try and remember what gives us joy. And that's often a really, really difficult exercise, because when we're really deeply exhausted and burned out, we have lost all contact with these feelings, these emotions. You can't even remember what that feels like. So I think it's very important to connect with past memories in which we felt very alive and very joyful and very full of vitality and zest. So because we also need a working towards goal when we're exhausted, not just moving away from goals. We don't just want to focus on what we don't want to experience anymore, but we also need to actually actively remember and envisage how we want to feel, what we want to feel in the future.
It's interesting you mentioned about the Stoicism, because I did a lot of reading on this a couple of years ago, and the circle of control. And one of the things that I learned, though, is I know it was at the time very easy for me to read and think, oh yeah, that makes sense, that's not in my control, don't worry about it. But I did kind of coach myself to be able to think like that. But then my wife pointed out to me, she says, you don't take anything seriously anymore. Because if something goes wrong, my initial reaction now is to think, can I change this? And, if I can't, I said, okay, I'm not going to worry about it. And, whereas my wife has not read Stoicism, and so she thinks you should react in a more maybe negative way, whereas I tend to say, okay, I'm neutral on this. There's nothing I can do. But what I can do is I can control the way I feel about something. So I noticed there was a little bit of conflict for those people who when they first learn about that circle of control, and it's certainly something I would recommend people go and research a little bit more, because it does change the way you think about events, because events happen and they're always going to happen. Bad things will always happen, and that's just been the way of the world, and it'll be the way of the world in the future. What we have, the only thing we have control over is how we feel about those events.
And it's also about energy, isn't it? You know, we have a limited amount of energy and attention. And and it is just wiser to spend energy and attention on what we can influence to a certain extent, because of course our inner lives are also not fully under our control.
Exactly.
I think the Stoics kind of overestimated our rationality. You know, there's a lot of irrationality in us as well, so we can't fully control what we're doing. But I think to attempt to do so is wise, and to just accept certain things that we cannot control can be a huge relief, you know, because we don't waste energy trying to control what we can't control in the first place.
Exactly. Yeah, it is. It's one of those weird things that once you learn it, it does feel like there's a weight off your shoulder. But you're right. I do think, I think in many ways, there are people who will say that, well, you can control your emotions and your feelings. And I tend to agree to a certain point, but I also know that there are days when you wake up and you're just not in the right mood. And there's an awful effort to put yourself into a different state on those days. So it's not quite as black and white as it would seem sometimes.
Yeah, I fully agree with that. That's why I'm actually a huge fan of acceptance and commitment therapy, which is a third wave cognitive behavioral therapy school of thought. And they also draw on ancient wisdom, especially, you know, Stoicism and, you know, the art of letting go. And basically proponents from that school argue that we just need to accept negative feelings and emotions and not always try and control them, not always try and repress them, not always try and, you know, work against them. But, you know, if we accept that they sometimes pop up in our heads and we notice them, we don't fuse with them, and then we let them go, that can be also a way of saving energy on the inside, you know, because ultimately it's all about not squandering our energies, which are limited in nature, on tasks that don't get us anywhere. And sometimes the repression of negative emotions can also be work, you know, and cost us a lot of our internal resources. And, you know, sometimes when we just accept, as you say, we have bad days, we have bad thoughts, we have an inner critic that pops up, we can look at it and say, is that useful to me right now, yes or no? If it isn't, we let it pass. But I don't think we always need to fight it, you know. It's also part of being human to be sad and depressed and anxious sometimes.
Yeah, and actually that's an interesting point that you make there, because I was going to ask you, is how important is self-awareness, self-knowledge in helping people to be less exhausted and avoid burnout?
I think it's hugely important, because we're all very different, and what energizes us and what drains us tends to be completely different from person to person. You know, like a simple example is people who are more introverted and people who are more extroverted, and introverted people need to recover by being on their own and, you know, reading and withdrawing from social interactions, whereas extroverted people get energy from being with others. And they find being on their own usually stressful or unsatisfying and boring. So I think we need to know, first of all, what our preferences are, our natural preferences. And we also need to know our patterns, because we all have patterns. You know, we have patterns of thinking, we have core beliefs about ourselves, we have things that trigger us, we have events in our past that really shaped us and that make us react really irrationally at certain moments in our lives, because we're triggered and something older is being, you know, awoken that we can't really make sense of. So I think the more we know about our unconscious patterns, the more we can also at least recognize them, not master them necessarily, but understand why they're there. And that in itself can be hugely helpful, because then we don't blame ourselves so much when, you know, when we have irrational reactions, but we kind of remember where they come from. And we can be a bit more compassionate with ourselves as well. And I think with regards to energy and exhaustion, self-knowledge is really absolutely crucial, you know, to know what revivifies you, what gives you pleasure, joy, and what drains you, and also what kind of patterns you are burdened with and how they impact on you in your present. And I guess the idea is not to let our patterns determine our future too much, you know, as far as we can.
Yes, I think that there's a quote that says, like, your past doesn't equal your future.
Yes.
And I've always loved that, because I've always been aware that everybody has the power to change, because we can change the way we think about ourselves anytime. And but it starts with that self-knowledge, self-awareness, because if you don't know who you are, you don't know who you want to become either. So it's
exactly
like you need a starting point, and that's where you are today. So that's self-awareness and self-knowledge, knowing what you're good at, what you're not good at, so that you can decide, you know, where can I improve? And you know, that's that self-improvement side. And that's always motivating. That's always energized me, is that belief that at any time I could decide to change. I don't obviously change all the time, but there are things I'll wake up and think, you know, maybe one day I think, you know, I'm not really happy with the way I react in these situations. And, you know, I can think, so what can I do to change that? I know what you mean about that self-awareness, self-knowledge. It is really a big part of, you know, being aware of what are going to be, what are the trigger points to that mental. I think mental exhaustion is more difficult to see or understand than physical exhaustion. I don't know if you've ever come across that.
Yeah, I think there's also, you know, a lot of people are exhausted or burned out because of work, you know, and that is actually trickier to treat, because many of us can't just quit our jobs or revolutionize our working environments and completely reform everything. I mean, a lot of us are stuck in structures that are not great for us and that are actually making us ill. And yet there's also an inner dimension to stress and exhaustion and burnout. And quite a lot of us are also, I think, really drained by what I call the inner critic, you know, like a negative critical voice in our heads that, you know, like just says unpleasant stuff about our skills, our performance, our ability. And this kind of critical inner voice can be incredibly draining as well, you know, because we may even be high achievers, do really well in our jobs, and from the outside look incredibly successful. But if we have an inner critic, you know, they have the gift to throw mud on everything and, you know, sully all achievement, and, you know, they always want more, they're never happy. So we can have this energy draining creature on the inside, a part of ourselves, you know, that, I mean, psychologists have come up with lots of different names for the inner critic. We can call it the super ego, we can call it negative automatic thoughts, we can call it, you know, the inner demon or a gremlin or whatever. But I think most of us will be familiar with this sort of you know, unfriendly inner voice, and that can be a huge additional stress factor. And when that is paired up with external stress, I think that's where the combination becomes really toxic.
Yeah, actually, a trick that I learned quite a while ago now is if ever I say anything negative, well, if I ever say the word I or the two words I can't, I immediately go, why? Mentally, I don't just suddenly shout it out in the street. But if I ever catch myself going, I can't, I have to ask myself immediately, why? Why can't I? Now, what that does is, it could very well be that I cannot do it, but it's often because I've got, it's a way of uncovering a negative self-belief. And that's something that, again, it comes back to that self-knowledge, self-awareness, and it uncovers things that I probably didn't know about myself. And so just by pausing and just say, why can't I do that? And, you know, I remember, because I love the history of the Apollo space program from the 1960s. I just thought that was just an amazing achievement, human achievement. And I often think, oh, I would like to go to the moon. And then I thought to myself, nah, I can't. And I immediately went, why? And I went, actually, because I just wouldn't want to go to the moon. I would feel so isolated. And I like to read about it, but it's just that I don't have the desire or the passion to go there. And then I can let it go, because I don't have the passion or the desire to go to the moon, but it doesn't mean that I cannot do it if I really had the passion or the desire, because I would probably try and figure out a way of doing it, but I don't have the desire, so it's never going to happen.
I really like that, you know, this I can't, why. It's a nice mental trick, isn't it?
It is.
I also, there's a technique that I really like. It's called cognitive diffusion. And it's from acceptance and commitment therapy as well. And the idea is that we are not our thoughts. And when we have negative thoughts, we can actually attempt to put a bit of distance between ourselves and the thought. And a really easy way of doing that is to add, I think that, in front of your negative thought, you know. And it could be like, you know, I mean, usual, very common negative thoughts are like, nobody likes me, I'm not lovable, you know, I'm really bad at my job. And we can, when we start having, when we notice having these thoughts, we can add, I think that I'm really bad at my job. And then you already create a really important gap between yourself and that thought. And you can look at that thought as what it is, you know, just a negative thought that is probably not true and usually quite unhelpful. And you can really train your brain to create that cognitive distance, to defuse from the thought that isn't helpful at that point in time. And that can be incredibly powerful, because that way, that thought isn't our reality, but we actually notice it's just a thought, you know, it's not even true. And it's not particularly helpful. And then we can let it go.
No, I like that too. It's rather than making it a positive, affirmative statement by introducing the word, I think, there's an element of doubt as well now. And therefore, it's not as powerful as it would have been if you just said, I'm not good at my job. Because it's like a definitive statement. And you're more likely to believe that. But if you say, I think I'm not really good at my job, now there's an element of doubt. So it's not as strong anymore.
Yeah. And you can even add one more layer. You can add, I notice that I think that I'm not particularly good at my job. You know, because that way you actually, you notice what is happening. You notice what your brain is doing. And you're just looking at it saying, it's not particularly helpful. It's not the reality. You know, it's just a thought. It's just words. Yeah. It's a habit of thinking about ourselves that doesn't get us anywhere. And then we can let it go.
Now, one thing that you mentioned a little bit earlier, which was about like the work environment and how that has an effect on our energy levels and vitality. And I was going to ask you actually, would you say that our work environments are a big contributor to the levels of exhaustion and burnout today? Like, has the pandemic and the increase in working from home helped, or has that exacerbated the problem?
Yeah, I think the jury is out on that question. I think some people love working from home, myself included. I've always been a huge fan of home working. But that's also because I'm really introverted, and it costs me a lot of energy, you know, to small talk and be amongst people and in bigger groups. So I much prefer to, you know, have that in small bursts, not all day, every day, but to have these interactions when I choose to have them. But other people thrive on seeing others, and they need to bounce ideas back and forth. And they, you know, also workplaces have become really important social hubs for most of us. You know, that's where we see other people. And when we suddenly don't see other people anymore on a regular basis, that can make many people feel incredibly lonely and disconnected. And then I think also online, relationships can deteriorate easier, more easily, you know, on email and on Zoom. Everything is very effect oriented, you know, like everything has a purpose, everything is instrumentalized. Like, you don't tend to meet to chat on Zoom. It's like usually a very purpose driven way of meeting. So the kind of little nice moments kind of fall by the wayside, and they tend to be particularly important for working culture, for feeling connected, for feeling as part of a team, and for just, you know, having nice moments and remembering that your coworkers are lovely human beings, and, you know, seeing their nice side, not just their work flaws, you know. So it's I think it's a huge problem that the kind of, you know, the photocopy chat culture is declining. And then also the, you know, the ways in which our leisure time and our work time blend into each other, merge, because we're doing everything in the same space. We don't have a commute that, you know, provides a bit of distance, you know, like a getting there, getting home, that can be very good for clearing your head and, you know, preparing and then relaxing. So all of that falls away, and that can be usually problematic. But on the bright side, you know, people can work in environments that they might prefer, but I think a lot of it's a really, really individual question. A lot of people hate it, and some people absolutely love it. And in terms of productivity, I guess it also has to do with whether the person working from home loves it or hates it. The person who likes it is probably going to be usually productive working from home. The person who wants to be in the office and misses human contact will probably not be particularly productive.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm more introverted as well. So I just love being, you know, in my own space and to create that working environment that I enjoy working in. I don't have to be, it's not dictated by some office architect who says, oh, everyone's going to enjoy this, because I might not enjoy that. Somebody else might, but I might not. So yeah, I like that. But then again, I think, like you say, introverts, generally speaking, are more likely to want to prefer working at home because they can have that quiet space, and the extroverts are probably going to hate it. So yeah, I can see that. And so on that working environment and the work that you've done looking at exhaustion, do you think there is a way that we can build better working environments in the future? Because as you say, we are the jury is still out on working from home, working in an office. But companies are desperately searching for that perfect halfway house, which probably will end up not pleasing anyone. But is there a way where we can build better working environments where people can thrive and be a lot less exhausted?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of things that managers can do in order to protect their workforce from burnout. And I actually do think that burnout is ultimately also very much the responsibility of line managers. They have to make sure that they protect their workers from slipping into this condition and staying there for a long time, because often it is because of, you know, unreasonable deadlines, but it can also be about, feeling disrespected at work. I think, lack of respect and a lack of a sense of dignity and a sense of being appreciated is often a huge contributing factor, and a sense of unfairness, that we're not treated fairly at work. And then I think a lot of us probably have to do stuff that we don't enjoy doing and we're not particularly good at. So I think job crafting, allowing people actually to identify their strengths and then mainly working in the areas in which they can really excel and which they're really good at and which doesn't cost them too much energy, can also be a really smart move, and there's a lot of research on job crafting, allowing people to follow their strengths. And I mean, there has to be someone who coordinates that, of course, because strengths have to combine into something that works in a systemic way. But but ultimately, I think that we're missing a huge trick here by not looking at what people's core talents are and in which areas they could make the biggest and best and most effortless contribution. And then I guess there's always the social dimension. I think people really do need to feel as part of a well-functioning team. They need to have a sense that they matter, their work matters, that they're respected, and that that they have a valuable contribution to make. And a lot of people are very bad at making their staff feel that. I mean, it's surprising by how many people don't do the basics when it comes to signaling gratitude, appreciation, and care, and extending that to workers.
Yeah. But in my time working with some bosses, there were some bosses that were completely fixated on their targets, and they didn't focus on developing their workforce. So we just felt like we were a cog in the wheel, as they say. But you just reminded me of something that I read. Jimmy Carr, as in the British comedian Jimmy Carr, in 2020 wrote a self-help book. Now, I've forgotten the title off the top of my head, but it's actually a brilliant book. Very funny, because he is a comedian. But one of the questions he says, you mentioned there about work crafting. And one of the questions he asked is, ask yourself, what can you do easily that other people find difficult? Because that's going to show you where your natural skill set is. And I thought, wow, that is just a brilliant question to ask yourself. What can I do easily that other people find difficult? Now, I've always found presenting on stage, even though I'm an introvert, I always found presenting on stage really easy. I didn't get nervous. I actually got excited. But most of my colleagues and most of my students when I was teaching English here in Korea, they were really, really scared of just standing up in front of an audience. And yet I loved that. And I thought, well, I find that easy. And then it sort of led me down the road thinking, well, perhaps communication is an area that I should be focused on. And now, obviously, I have YouTube channels and blog posts, and I communicate, and I love it. It's just, I find it actually very easy. But so many people that, oh, I couldn't do that. And I thought, that's a really powerful question. What can you do easily that other people find difficult?
Yeah, I think that's a great question.
So that's you just reminded me of that when you mentioned the work crafting. I thought, yeah, a lot of people, if they just step back sometimes and just ask, what can I do easily that other people find difficult? That will push you in the right, in the direction of where your skills are likely to be. And if you find it easy, it's not going to be exhausting.
Absolutely. And ideally there should be some kind of match between what we do on a daily basis and what we find easy to do and doesn't cost us too much energy.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to come to the final question now, which is the life hack signature question, which is, at Life Hack, we believe that life is nothing without the time to live it. What is one thing that you would regret if you're not investing enough time in it, and why?
Oh yeah, that's a very good question. I would definitely say relationships. You know, that's always what comes back as what makes life most meaningful for me. So I wish I would invest more time in all of my relationships, less time in work, more time in my relationships. And I think that's a dilemma that a lot of us probably are very familiar with, you know, the sense that you really have to use your time very wisely. And I'm putting scare quotes, you know, by working as much as we can, but that's not actually a wise use of our time. I think that's actually also a way of wasting precious time, because ultimately it's about what matters most. And I would say definitely relationships. And then I also think that it's really good to do something that is totally unproductive and serves no purpose whatsoever other than giving us joy. And that can be, you know, we can use the word hobby for that. It can be something we're not even particularly good at, but it just has to be something that we really like doing. And and I think, you know, I think hobbies have to make a comeback soon, because they're in a way really revolutionary when we really look at them as something that has no function other than to give us joy. And it can't be about enhancing skills. It can't be about, you know, upping our cultural capital or doing something Instagrammable, you know. Like, I think hobbies really should be as ridiculous and non-productive and strange as possible. And then they can be really, really powerful.
You just reminded me of my little hobby, which is really ridiculous and very unproductive, which is watching British detective dramas and trying to figure out who did it. I do that every Saturday night because it gets me off the way from the computer. I'll watch a detective drama, something like Vera or Midsummer Murders or even Death in Paradise. And I'm watching it and then I say, it's him or it's her. And at the end, when it's revealed, I go, yes, or going, oh, I should have seen that. But it's my, I get a little buzz from it. My wife thinks it's really boring. So to me, it's my little hobby. It's just watching detective dramas and trying to figure out as quickly as possible who did it.
Yeah, that's a great example. Yeah, I mean, the geekier, the better.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yes.
And I also love that, you know, we don't have to be good at our hobbies. You know, we can be quite hopeless at our hobbies, and it doesn't matter at all, you know, because it's not about excelling or, you know, being perfect at something. It's just really about doing something that gives joy.
Yeah, it does. And I thoroughly enjoy these detective dramas, so it's really good. Well, thank you so much, Anna, for being with us today. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. And where can people find more about you if they want to learn more about, you know, what you do?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you. I really enjoyed our conversation, Carl. I've got a website. It's the Exhaustion Coach, and that has a lot of links and has links to some of my blogs and journalistic writings. And I've also just published a book, which is called The Art of Self-Improvement, 10 Timeless Truths. And that book traces many of our current self-help trends and, you know, assumptions about self-improvement back to their ancient roots. So I look at, you know, the history of the idea of self-improvement and how it developed over time and which techniques, which assumptions are still with us, and, you know, why they still matter. And I think it's actually the ancient strategies from which we have most to learn, because they stayed around for a reason. It's because they work, you know, because they're still effective. That would be my recommendation.
That's fantastic. Well, we'll make sure there is a link to your website in the show notes below. So again, thank you very much, Anna. Now, if you would like to learn more about de-stressing, refocusing on what's important and re-energizing yourself, then here at Life Hack, we have the perfect Toolkit. Our Mindful Focus Toolkit will teach many of the aspects we've discussed today and a lot more. Full details of the toolkit are in the show notes below. Thanks again, and I look forward to seeing you in the next show.